Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the fourth session on the deceptive nature of the mind. Today we are going to focus on the two extremes that Buddha has advised us to avoid in his first sermon, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, or the discourse on setting the wheel of Dharma in motion. You might have learn the sutra in different languages by using different terms. Usually, at the beginning, I think in the first paragraph of the sutra, Buddha asks, Pabbajitena, by someone who has gone forth. So Pabbajita, the layman's translation of Pabbajita is one who is ordained. But today is the fifth, today is session number five, sorry about that. So you might have come across different translations of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutra, different teachers, different translators, English translators use different terminology. Now, at the beginning of the sutra, Buddha asks Pabbajitas, P-A-B-B-A-J-I-T-A, Pabbajita. Pabbajita, which in layman's language is one who is ordained, meaning one who has become monastic. Literally, the literal meaning would be one who has gone forth, meaning as opposed to ordinary lay people who get stuck. That's two different meanings. We don't have to refer to the Pali words. A monk or a nun or a monastic is someone who is no longer getting stuck and going forth. Whereas a lay person is getting stuck. Those are the literal meanings. However, Buddha has thoroughly advised Pabbajitas. Pabbajitas mean those who have taken up the robes or those who have left their home life, their lay life, in order to walk away from getting stuck so that they can continue towards their goal, spiritual goal. However, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta is not only for monks, because why Buddha has used the word Pabbajita is that the 100% of his first audience was Pabbajitas, or monks, monastics. So that is why he addressed them as Pabbajitas. Whereas in later sutras, and he wouldn't use the word Pabbajita, and instead he would use the word Bhikkhave, or Bhikkhus. Bhikkhus again has different meanings. The pre-Buddhist meaning of Bhikkhu is one who begs. And then there are two pre-Buddhist meanings. Pre-Buddhist definitions of bhikkhu, B-H-I-K-K-H-U. First meaning is one who begs, one who lives on begging, requisites begging alms from people. That's the first meaning, first pre-Buddhist meaning. Second pre-Buddhist meaning is chinna bhinna pata dharati iti bhikkhu. It's a long phrase. I'm just reading for recording purpose. Chinna bhinna pata dharati iti bhikkhu. Chinna cut. Bin, broken, putter, rags, dharatiti, wearing, bhikkhu. One who wears robes made of rags collected from a cemetery or elsewhere, meaning so that it is cut and broken. Later on, when the sasana was established, the kings and rich people would start offering robes. But still, Buddha discouraged to have a robe that is made of a single piece of cloth. Because so that Buddha recommended that robes be made if a monk gets a single piece, and it would cut into few pieces. And so that would serve two purposes. First is it is devalued. The second purpose is it gives you a sense of anicca, impermanence. It is not, robe itself is not a single piece. Our life, our existence is not a single, it is fragmental. Life is fragmental. Different sankharas are put together so that you come up with what is called life or living or existence. Those are the two, that is the purpose later on. However, so those are the two pre-Buddhist definitions of bhikkhu. And Buddha redefined the term bhikkhu again. Samsare bhayang ikkhati iti bhikkhu. Samsare bhayang ikkhati iti bhikkhu. A bhikkhu is one who sees the dreadful nature of existence or samsara. At that point, when Buddha speaks to monastics, whether male or female, he would specifically use bhikkhu and sangha. All this still, when he gives, even when his audience is comprised of both male and female monastics and male and female lay people, and then he would still use the word bhikkhave in plural. At that point, what the means by that is, a lay person cannot be a bhikkhu. But why then Buddha would address all these four groups by calling them bhikkhus is specifically to describe his audience. Whether be it a monk, be it a nun, be it a lay woman, be it a lay man, They have come to him for a common purpose, to see, to understand the dreadful nature of samsara, their existence. So that's why he calls bhikkhave. There's a long, long definition. I tried to, quickly go through. It was like a fast track kind of explanation because we are coming to this point, pabbajita. So pabbajita, why would that just as the monks, so his first audience, when he was giving his maiden sermon after spiritual, his Sammasambuddha achievement or his enlightenment, is that all 100% of his audience was comprised of monastics. So, however, this is a universe. This is not only for monks or monastics. This is only for all the lay and ordained, everyone, this sutta, because this the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta encapsulates all the teachings of the Buddha. Now, this is the base, this is the foundation of his teaching. The foundation is the middle path. The middle path, Majjhima Patipada, M-A-J-J-H-I-M-A, Majjhima, long A, Majjhima, then Patipada, P-A-T-I, diacritical mark, dot underneath T, pa, T, I, P-A-D-A, Patipada, Majjhima, Patipada, the middle path. Now, for the first time in India's religious history, it was the Buddha who introduced Majjhima, Patipada, or the middle path, or in layman's language, life in moderation, or moderate life, moderate living, even in the case of spirituality. I have a lot of experience with monks and lay people who got into trouble by following either extreme. So we are going to talk about, you should, the traditional English translation of, you are familiar with this traditional English translation of the two extremes, self-indulgence. That is the hedonist extreme, or hedonist or hedonistic approach. Second one is ascetic, that is attakilamatana yoga, or the self-mortification. Self-indulgence means you indulge, you always help your body engage in luxury. So that is a hedonistic approach. Now, whereas ascetic is you mortify your body, self-mortification. So you mortify your body. You get your body mortified through religious practice. In a way that, so when you give your body as much comfort as possible, according to a religious belief, that the body would completely get devoid of all the negativities. There'll be no more room for dukkha in your body, so that you will achieve enlightenment, liberation. That's one extreme. But Siddhartha wanted to try that extreme because he was a king. He had all his luxuries in his life. Of course, he got awakened into his life when he saw a sick man, so an elderly man, and then a dead body, and a monk. The four signs, the four painful signs, the four realistic signs of existence. And he was only happy with the last one, the sight of a monk. When he saw a sick man, that's when he asked his assistants, right? Channa would later become a monk, and he would break up with the Buddha anyway, because he said, "I am the one who helped you to become the Buddha. Now you are ignoring me." It happens in organizations. So sometimes. So the first comer. Channa would later on fall apart. So he would break up with the Buddha, and later, and he would Buddha didn't much to tame him. So that is when Buddha recommended that when Buddha has passed away, the monks would declare what is called Brahma Dandana, or the verbal boycott. So as for Channa to get tamed by himself. So that was called Brahma Dandana. Brahma is the noble, divine. Dandana means penalty or punishment. Noble one. So that is the noble punishment. In case you can tame anyone, have metta to that. Continue to have metta to that person, but don't talk to him or her. That's the way you tame people, right? So that there's no coming. So, however, Channa is the one who explained to Siddhartha what those four sides were and what they mean. And that's when he got... Siddhartha never wanted to, upon becoming a wandering monk, Siddhartha never wanted to try the hedonist. The hedonist extreme. So as you know, the hedonistic approach is to... and there's another word for hedonist is sensualist. Probably that is easier than ascetic. Sensualist or hedonist extreme. Now it was an actual religious belief. There were so many people, and you can see those people nowadays in society also. I have come across a lot of people, my friends. They are called urban Buddhists. Urban Buddhists. I mean, they only need a very fancy interior room for meditation. They only need all these fancy romantic music. And I teach aromatherapy anyway, but I do that. I like aromatherapy and music, but I do that in order to achieve samatha. However, I know I have been a lot of places in the U.S. run by rich people. They only rich people. They only target retired people, and they can like certain religious groups, some certain church always target retired people so that they can grab the money. And there are such hedonist spiritual practitioners in the U.S. It's a lucrative business, and they target their audiences, their customers actually, not audience. Their customers are rich people. And I have seen to such people, sometimes they invite me for opening ceremonies. I would have a cup of tea, and then they would ask, "Pante, how would you find my new business?" I said, I would simply say, it's beautiful, it is attractive, it's so impressive that I don't deserve to be here. And sometimes, I know what you mean, Pante. I know that you wouldn't like. I said, no, it's not liking or hating. I said, I don't deserve to be here. That's the way, so I'm not insulting. Yes, it does, I don't deserve to be that in place. It's too much for me. Right? So that's, I have seen this this hedonist, hedonist spiritualists. So, and it was an actual religious practice during the Buddha's time, and that religious belief would attract a lot of people, hedonist. Yeah, exactly. I'm writing an article on that, but not me in January, actually. I'm collecting data for that, like mindfulness. This has become like a fancy, romantic practice. So that's hedonist. So Siddhartha Ney wanted to practice the hedonist extreme, sensualist. And then, so he in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutra, he uses these words to explain the characteristics, the nature of the hedonist extreme, the extreme of hedonism, as opposed to the extreme of asceticism. The first one is hina, meaning base, as opposed to supreme. And the second one is gamma, meaning vulgar. That's the second one. Vulgar has a different meaning too. It has a specific meaning when it comes to sexuality too, raga. But here the vulgar, then we'll let explain what why it's called vulgar. Second characteristic of that is gamma. And third one is potujjanika, because you are familiar. Potujjanika is a compound, whereas putujjana is the noun. Putujjana, you are very familiar with putujjana, meaning common. If you are the same common person, what's the meaning of your spiritual practice? That's what it means. If you remain on the same level, there's no improvement. That's what it common here means. Common, potujjanika. And the fourth characteristic is anariya, ignoble. That's, so the anariya is the opposite of ariya. Ariya, you are familiar with the word ariya or arya. Chatu ariya satcha, the four noble truths. So anariya is made of, so anariya is na plus ariya. Na is, na means not. Ariya, noble. Not noble, meaning ignoble.
Like Nirodha.
Yeah, like Nirodha too, yeah. So ignoble. And the number five, the characteristic number five is unprofitable, that is anatta sanghita. Anatta sanghita. So anatta, that's also anatta means, sorry, I made a mistake. N-A-N-A-T-T-H-A, anatta. Otherwise, thank you. Look. Samahita too. It's a M-A-H-I-T-A, samahita. Thanks. So, anatta is na atta. Na means not. Atta meaning. No meaning. No meaning means meaningless.
Non-cognitive.
Yeah. So that's anatta. Sanghita means containing, comprised of, leading to. Yeah. Unprofitable. Leading to no profit. So, anatta sanghita is unprofitable. Profitable. Pardon my spelling sometimes. Maybe I mispronounced some both Pali and English words. So this is now the extreme of the nature of the extreme of hedonism that Buddha is asking us to avoid is that would generally translate as self-indulgence. Kama Sukallikanu Yoga, the extreme of hedonism is hina, it is hina, it is base, it is gamma, it is vulgar, it is potujjanika, it is common, and it is anariya, it is ignoble, and it is anatta sanghita, is unprofitable. Now these are the characteristics of the hedonist practice. Now you would see that the hedonist extreme has five characteristics, five. Whereas the other one, the ascetic extreme or the extreme of asceticism only has three characteristics. And later, I'm just still going through this term, then we will come to the discussion. Okay. Now, the ascetic, meaning that is self-mortification. It has three characteristics. Dukkha, that is, dukkha, it's an English word nowadays, as you know, it has different meaning, unsatisfactoriness, not necessarily suffering, because I personally don't like, a lot of scholars also don't agree to suffering as the translation of dukkha, because there's another word called sukha. Buddha hasn't denied the luxury or anything. Of course, our sensory existence, during our existence, we actually enjoy happiness. So it's called unsatisfactoriness. Unsatisfactoriness is way different than the term suffering. When you say suffering, there's nothing but suffering. There's no happiness. Whereas the word unsatisfactoriness implies that you have done something already, but you are still unhappy. So that's unsatisfactoriness is accurate. At least it's way better than the suffering. Now, that's the first characteristic of ascetic practice is, or the ascetic extreme is, it is dukkha or self-afflictive. Why the translation self-afflictive is, who suffers? It's your feeling, it's your body, it is your life. So that is why we put self-afflictive. It's a different story that you may feel someone else's dukkha, but it's not as you feel your own dukkha. So it's all about self. So the first characteristic of the extreme of asceticism or the ascetic extreme is that it is dukkha or it is self-afflictive. And the second characteristic is that it is anariya, and we already went through that, anariya, ignoble. And the third and last characteristic of the ascetic extreme is unprofitable, the Pali term of which is anatta sanghita. Now, here, did you notice here, does the list of characteristics of, which extreme? Is it the hedonist extreme or the ascetic extremes that has the characteristic of hina, base, and vulgar, gamma? See, the common characteristics are, so hedonist approach is ignoble, anariya, and so is the ascetic extreme, anariya, and the hedonist approach is unprofitable, anatta sanghita, and so is the ascetic approach, unprofitable. So now you don't see dukkha on the list of hedonism. So that caught my eyes when I studied the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutra in monastic high school. Because I would always play the word dukkha in my head. Dukkha, dukkha, dukkha. Where is this dukkha? Am I dukkha? Is me dukkha? Then when I went through, I didn't notice dukkha in the explanation, in the description of hedonist extreme. And I only saw that in, I didn't see that in ascetic. Why is that? Two reasons. Why the hedonist approach leads to, why the ascetic approach leads to dukkha? Why not the hedonist approach? Why only the ascetic approach? that is considered self-afflictive or dukkha, dukkha-oriented. Because Buddha tried, sorry, Siddhartha tried it. He was an ascetic Siddhartha, actually. Samana. He was an ascetic. He was not a normal practitioner. Now, what he experienced during his extreme asceticism was further dukkha. He experienced further dukkha. He was already fed up with all the luxuries he had. That's when it was an eye opening to him when he saw when he noticed the sight of a sick person, and then old person, and then a dead body. And it was pleasing to see the sight of a monk. Right? So he was already fed up with luxuries. When you read Siddhartha's biography, you might have seen that his father, King Suddhodana, had arranged all kind of luxuries for him, all kind of entertainment. He had three palaces, the spring palace, summer palace, and the winter palace for three seasons. The winter palace was the interior of the winter palace was full of murals of fire burning. So that when he saw the fire, and then you don't need to actual, how to say, and that would give you, when you see the, see, it is very psychological. You don't have to have a fireplace. Unless you don't have, let's say you got lost in the winter time, and you got lost in the forest. I noticed I have actually interviewed some people in Canada. The hikers, how they got lost, it would get stranded for like maybe at least 48 hours. So sometimes if they are too far, they will always talk about fire, their fireplace. When they talk about their fireplace, they will automatically, they feel like they are getting warmed up. It's very psychological. And the summer palace would, the summer palace interior would have waterfalls. So that is how. Not a moment was Siddhartha left to think that life was negative. He was always given all kind of luxuries. However, still, he wasn't happy. And someone could argue that it is because he was destined to be the Buddha. However, that is a different story. But when he experienced, and I was going to say, there were beauty queens, beautiful girls like Apsaras, and they would, when Siddhartha is staying in an entertainment hall surrounded by his palace guards and a lot of people, and with the music playing, and there were dancers. There were damsels dancing, beautiful girls dancing. So what happens was, Siddhartha would fall asleep a few hours later. He had zero interest in those dances and in those beautiful girls. And so when they noted that the prince had now fallen asleep, and they would also fall asleep, and Siddhartha would wake up a few hours after midnight, at 3 a.m., 4 a.m., and he used that, how terrible all those girls were. They were snoring and they were doing a lot of things, and they are, so they're making different sounds. That is what Siddhartha was impressed with. Not the dances, not the music. When he woke up in the middle of the night, all those beautiful girls had fallen asleep, and when he just scanned around and he saw, oh, this is the actual nature. However, he didn't find them disgusting. That's very interesting. He wasn't specifically impressed with those girls either. And he, so that it was in between. He had a realistic approach, and he wouldn't condemn them. In the case of a normal king, what would happen? Those girls would get beheaded, or maybe they got imprisoned, and they would immediately get kicked out from the palace. Why? Normal king would want only a normal person, like a king, who has access to all the luxuries, would love to see those beautiful girls, only to look beautiful, even in their sleep. And Siddhartha didn't find it disgusting. And he wasn't impressed either. It was in between. He thought, okay, this is what happens. He already experienced what dukkha is in there. So, ascetic extreme only gave him more dukkha. So that is why he asked to avoid it. Whereas when it comes to the extreme of hedonism, the first three characters are very important, are of prime importance. The hedonist approach is base, it's hina, and it is vulgar, it's gamma. So, when it comes to, don't get me wrong that I am against rich people. So most of my friends are extremely rich people, even though I don't ask them for anything. I don't want. But I know the way they think. This is what I'm going to say. See, did I tell you in one of my previous sessions, I know the couple of Hollywood people. I'm not going to name them, even if you ask me, even if you pay me, I'm not going to disclose their names. Two of them would be regular meditators in the temple where I was residing for three years in California, in North Hollywood. They had more complaint than lower middle class poor people, middle class people. So the middle class people or the lower middle class people or the poor or the middle class people would come and complain about their bigger problems, how to fund their children's education, or how to pay their mortgage, and how to pay their, big bills. Whereas those who rich one, they would always and come and say, sometimes they would set up an appointment and say, my insurance refused to pay for my broken nails because I hadn't insured my nails. And then they would say, and then they would come up with a plethora of complaints. They would always say that they were blaming, they were cursing and blaming insurance companies and all, because and they had also been to, they had that time in early 2000, between 99 through 2001, 2003, those years, there were not these fancy mindfulness places. But still there were some, they were more expensive. But now it is now mindfulness and romantic spiritualist places are highly competitive now, so that you can get a bigger discount. Those days, back in the days, there were only few places in California. So, and some had some of those rich people, not simply rich, they are affluent people, they had been to those places, they were still unhappy. Why? They would say, I only paid more money, but I didn't get the kind of relief that I was looking for. Then, because they were, one girl was extremely, extremely unhappy, that she had already filed a lawsuit against the insurance company. She wasn't unhappy that even though spiritual places didn't help her. Then I said, okay, beautiful lady. And she was happy to hear that. Okay, beautiful lady. Beautiful. So now, is not about the insurance policy, insurance coverage. It's not about those fancy spiritual places. It's not about your nails. It's all about your the way you look at your problem. You need to apply the middle path. That's called the moderate approach. That's called, what is that? So that's called the middle path. Now, so when you are over limit, even you forget about the spiritual practice, even in your day-to-day life, when you are too much into something and you land in trouble. And later she would come for meditation, and then one day I asked her, she looked very simple. One day she came all, she was clad in white, white gown. Then I told her, you look more relaxed in that dress. So that I told, because I didn't say, I said that in the with everyone present, otherwise it would have passed a wrong message. I said, I'm in good faith, I'm just saying, you look more relaxed today. And she said, because I felt relaxed, I thought I should come to the temple in this dress. This is my wedding dress. This is my wedding dress. It's a very simple gown, long gown. I said, that's good. Then what is the connection between wedding dress and your relaxation? He said, well, do you see that I don't have any makeups today? Yeah, I have noticed that you were, but only, I said, this is the way I said, well, whether or not you put makeup, I don't know, maybe you are beautiful anyway. So I never used the word attractive, but I'm not supposed to say that word. I said, beautiful. So the dialogue would continue, and she would later tell me, yes, I thought that today I didn't put any makeup at all, because I had addicted to makeups. Addictive. So in her case, to see the self-addictive. Now, she was into extreme, she had an extreme hedonist approach to her life. But it didn't make any sense. Still, she had dukkha anyway. However, her problem was, she felt that she had, this is one word she said, I had the perspective, Bandhi, I lost it. Every day I feel like I'm slipping into a precipice, and I'm further, I feel more and more down. That's called heena, base. There's no way to stand up. So that she would, at times she said she would hate her body. She would hate her physical body. She would curse it. So that is called gamma, vulgar. I know when it comes to sexual approach too, sexualist approach too, a lot of people are in my counseling session, they have told me, if there's one thing that they hate, is they hate their body now. I said, okay, that could be the disaster. Then I would simply, it's a disaster. Because it's a different story that in a relationship would always want your partner to look as to attract to you, whereas when you condemn your own physical body. So the hedonist approach gives us a heena mindset, a vulgar mindset, common, ignoble. So all these four characteristics. So the five characteristics, base, vulgar, common, ignoble, and unprofitable. So there's no improvement in your life. You can't see an improvement because there could be more reasons for you to argue with others, break up with others, find fault with others. When you use the hedonist in your day-to-day life, I mean, yeah, it wouldn't make any difference when it comes to spirituality too. See, nowadays, when I speak to Catholics and a lot of devout Catholics and Christians, I know sometimes they say there are certain different denominational groups within Christianity. And they always, I said, not only in Buddhism too, I said that in all religions have those groups. They always, I know one group, I'm not going to name it. That's one Buddhist movement in Sri Lanka. They only want people, however expensive, they only want you to buy the most expensive flowers for the Buddha. And best fruits, like a mountain of fruit. They want you to use silver and gold trays to offer the Buddha, make offerings to Buddha. And they always promote the best things, even if people, so that what the thing is like a trend. Everything's a trend nowadays. So people would go for that, the rich people, some people, some poor people, the lower middle class or middle class people also try for that for some time. Later on they will get fed up with that. And later and come back to say, you know what, it's better to go to my austere village temple again. Sometimes. So that is when sometimes in religious practice people are, certain religious groups encourage you to, dress up very attractively. And also to use all the luxury, whatever gives you a luxurious look, like a fancy look. It's nothing wrong with that, but when it could lead to an extreme. So that is when Buddha never wanted that. And one of the, it was a part of the hedonist groups, and they would always wanted a bigger group. The bigger the community, and they would be happier. So that is what has happened in evangelism, in Buddhism, Christianity, whatever the religion. They want the bigger the congregation, they are much happier. Right? They always compete with other to grow their congregation. So you can always see in modern day too. So the Siddhartha never wanted them to see that. He never wanted the to try the hedonist approach, and because he was a king himself, and he tried in good faith the ascetic approach, the ascetic extreme, for 6 years, and he one of the things that he practiced was pancha P-A. In diacritical mark, tilde on top, pancha, like signora, pancha. Pancha is five, tapa, T-A, long A, P-A, tapa. Pancha, tapa. At noon, you will lie on your back with your eyes open, focusing on the sun, looking at the sun, and there are four more fires burning close to your feet, close to your head, and on your sides, close to your hips on both sides. So there are four fires burning, and there's another fire burning in the sky. So those are the fire panchatapa. Why? That was a very popular ascetic practice. In order to mortify your body, and so that the panchatapa would evaporate all your dukkha, so that you get your dukkha evaporated. The one thing was you get dehydrated, and you might even, that would cause your death. Right? So, when you have seen that very famous statue of ascetic Siddhartha from the Gandhara Museum, Gandhara, Afghanistan, Kabul Museum, I guess. Buddha had reduced, Siddhartha has been added to a skeleton. So I also saw the statue somewhere here.
This one in the
front
is covered
there. Yeah, it was somewhere, I saw that skeletal, the skeletal figure. Siddhartha has, the ascetic Siddhartha had been reduced to a skeleton. So that you could, you can simply see his bones were intact because of the skin, no flesh at all. And he explained later on, in his explanation, he said that when I touched my belly button, I felt my back. That's how he explains it. When I touched my belly button, I felt my back. So that is how ascetic his practice was, ascetic. Now, as opposed to those fancy spiritual places, anywhere in the world, there are certain monasteries that promote extreme asceticism. Now, I'm not against that, but I'm simply explaining, because I have a lot of ascetic monks too. Sometimes they live, they promote it. Sometimes they come to the media, national TV. I have noticed that. They are supposed to share their experience. One thing they would recommend, but it's meaningless to live your life like that. Give up everything. Let go of everything. Come to the forest. That is the actual practice. Whereas when I speak with them, they would come up with a bunch of complaints, a bunch of problems, they would say that. So they would always say that. I have noticed that one of my monastic friends, now once we were of the same age. One day I wanted to go on an educational trip. It was a pilgrimage. It was a pilgrimage plus an educational excursion. Expedition. So we all put in the bus, and there were novice monks, and they wanted to listen to some music. They wanted to take a break from that was in the 80s, so that I was a novice monk. And the bus driver would play music, first the religious one, later like fast music too, because we are all teenagers. And that my monastic friend, I was like 17, my ascetic friend, he got really angry. Really angry, and he said that if you told me, I wouldn't have joined this trip. I hate this. Then I told him, and then I cornered him. When you stop for a place for a tea, somewhere in Kandy, then I cornered him because he wanted to use the toilet. I said, okay, I'll come with you. The male men's toilet was like a little bit far. Then we went. Then I said, my friend, are you angry? Not really. I said, no, not really, because don't lie. I can see that you are angry. Now, this is the thing. I really appreciate what you are doing. You are doing something that I am not able to do. I really appreciate. I commend you for that, because you live in a forest. But with respect, you are my friend, but I respect you. I am not insulting you. Now, I wonder why you were not able to practice, at least practice upekkha in your life, because you could say, I wonder why you were not able to maintain your company, at the same time emotionally distancing yourself from those monks, novice monks who were at times singing. But singing is prohibited. Okay, that's true, but these are novice monks. Every full moon, they can renew their precepts. But that's not the case. So don't you think that you need more upekkha? I didn't say no, zero upekkha. I know it is zero upekkha, but I wasn't supposed to judge, but I was simply helping. Do you think that you need more upekkha? You need more equanimity? And he said to me, and then he felt guilty and said, did everyone tell you that they noted that I was angry? Then I asked him, okay, then I asked a counter question. When I asked when you were angry, they said, and not really, you said not really. Now you accept that you were angry. Yes, I was. Okay, you were angry now. And then I told him, see, don't think that I live in a village, I live in the community, but actually my ability to deal with situations is way much lower than yours. However, we need our upekkha to face situations. Overall, you could say, I practice upekkha, my life is an upekkha. But remember, this trip is a test paper for you. Mm-hmm. This is a test paper for you. So it's been only a few minutes since the driver started playing like fast music. And the monks were like not really dancing, but they were shaking their shoulders. And I also did the same thing. I said, it automatically happens. But you were like, you close your eyes. I saw that you were trying so hard. Don't you think that if you had your eyes wide open, you wouldn't have gotten that angry? When you close your eyes means you didn't go into meditation. Don't lie to me. And it was worse then. Why? Then you visualize yourself, your life in the forest, and then these monks entertaining. Yeah, that's what I did. I said, when you are frustrated, don't close your eyes. When you are frustrated, don't close your eyes. Depress you, people who are depressed would love to do that. Unless you are guided by someone for meditation. So that is when, see the point here? Even no matter how ascetic you are, it doesn't serve a purpose. However, when you are extremely ascetic, it is harmful to your practice. So that is when Buddha says, choose the middle path, the moderate. It has to be moderate. So that's when, see, the five ascetics were extremely angry with Siddhartha when he, with a lot of difficulty, it would take him, the Lalita Vistara, that is one of the Mahayana, a beautiful Mahayana Buddhist text in Sanskrit. It is available online too. I mean, the English translation is available for free download. The Lalita Vistara, L-A-L-I-T-A, Lalita. Lalita. Vistara, V-I-S-T-A-R-A, Vistara. Vistara in Sanskrit and Sinhalese means explanation, narrative, description. Lalita, Lalita means the stylish, the rhythm. Lalita Vistara, that book explains. That is one of the best texts, Buddhist texts, to know how ascetic, to have a clear-cut understanding of extreme ascetic practice during the Buddha's time. They explain the panchatapa and all the things. Some people would never clean their body. They would apply more and more ashes, and they would live in dirt, and they would practice. They would stand on one foot, as long as they could. The longer the stay on one foot, let's say we are practicing that, so that, let's say, how many people we are, six, then we are eight people. Right? Let's say we're going to have a retreat, 1 foot stand in retreat, retreat for standing on 1 foot. And whosoever gives up the earliest, and he is the weakest. And whosoever stands the longest is the strongest. It is so, and everyone gets so fascinated by whomsoever standing the longest, and so everyone else would feel like becoming his or her students. So that is how the extreme religious practice, asceticism, ascetic practice would be. And then, so I have learned a lot of, so when you are, I also stayed in a monastery, a famous monastery when I was a novice monk. Honestly, during the first 24 hours, I was happy. Extremely happy that I was able to make it. The second time, I had difficulty. There were so many mosquitoes, and once there was this rat, this garden snake creeping into the kuti also, and there were rats also. Then I felt, I got shaken. I got shaken for the moment. The next moment I would think, my bed in the monastery is way better than this. Second day. Then I never wanted to go to the third day. I was there. I didn't trust myself. However, I motivated myself. Next day, Upananda, you will be leaving this place, cursing yourself. Not the place, but yourself. Don't let that happen. So I stayed there, I think, 4 days or so. 4 days or so. And when I went the second time, I stayed there 18 days. The second time. So because I had to fix my attitude first. So the second time I went, I stayed there 18 days. But still, I had to fight my thoughts. Always there were more thoughts discouraged me to stay. And that was a big battle, right? So that is when. But I wasn't an ascetic. But I was already feeling heat. So that is how. Can you imagine when someone an actual ascetic goes through that? Now. So when it comes to ignoble, unprofitable, some translated, some scholars translate the first character of asceticism, dukkha, as denial. Because denial is another translation of dukkha. When you are in dukkha means you are in denial. When in extreme, when dukkha goes to in the extreme, is in denial. So more in spirituality, most people misunderstand denial as life lived in impermanence. So that's why people never lie. They never want others to. They would simply hate others to see others laughing, smiling. I know a lot of couples. Either one is extremely religious. They say that. However, when they see their husband or wife, cracking jokes, and they get angry, and sometimes they come to me and say, "Hey, Bhante," I say, "No, I'm not perfect. This is the way I could help you. You are not willing to laugh? You are not willing to smile?" I said, "Buddha also smiled. Even after his enlightenment, Buddha never lost his brain cells causing laughter or smile. There are specific cells in our brain that causes humor. They're called the brain cells of humor. And Buddha has a different. Buddha and enlightened people, especially they have what is called hasitupada chitta. They have hasita means laugh, smile. Uppada creating. Laughter, smile creating chitta. It's a pure chitta. But however, it has to be. There are different kind of. One day we will talk about those words like hasita. S-A-T-I-H-A. Hasita. Hasita or hasa. Hasita means, hasita is the past participle. Hasita upada. That a feeling or a chitta that keeps you smiling. That keeps you smiling. That is called hasita. You may be familiar with the story. One day Buddha and other monks were going on Pindapata, on alms collection. On the roadside, there was this piglet lying in its own feces. And Buddha simply turned his head and looked at them. He smiles. He smiled and Venerable Ananda saw that. Smiling? No, Ananda, look at that piglet. Yes, sir. Why is that? See, it's lying its own feces. But, sir, what is special about that? There's nothing to, because that's how they are. Pigs lie in dirt anyway. But this piglet is very special. Why? In his previous life, he was a deva. He was a deva. He was in heaven. He wasn't happy with his luxury. He was never happy. And he was sad. And he would hate. That negative karma landed him. And so he wasn't able to get reborn into heaven again. Not even humanity. And he was hateful. And he would find it disgusting, his heavenly life. So that he ended up in that, he was reborn as a piglet. But now, do you see Ananda? He is enjoying. He's enjoying the feast, his own feasts. He's lying in feasts. So that's why Buddha smiled. Now, hasitupada, hasa, H-A-S-A, longe, hasa is smile. In Sanskrit, it's called harsha, H-A-R-S-A, harsha. It's a popular male name in the Indian subcontinent, Sanskrit, harsha. Hasa is smile. Manda, M-A-N-D-A, manda. Manda means mild smile. Manda. Mild smile. And then upa, hasa. Sarcastic smile. Upahasa. And then upper hasa. Smile that insults someone. Insult, offensive smile. Upahasa. See? Hasa is smile. Manda hasa is mild smile. Upahasa, upahasa is sarcastic smile. Upahasa is offensive smile. See, there are different kinds of smiles. This is something extra sometimes. So, now, so laughter or smile is recommended. It's a good thing. However, my ascetic friend, he never wanted everyone else to smile or laugh. But then I even told, when we were returning from the pilgrimage, and I told him, when you go back to your monastery, when you go back to the forest, your hermitage, this is the way. Every time you feel like frustrating, every time you feel like your fellow monks are smiling, close your eyes, think about Hasitupada, Buddha is smiling with you. One day, 2 months later, I met him in nearby town. And he said that one day, so that he was frustrated with his own practice. And then it was a full moon day, around 3 a.m. Monks were, they had full moon meditation around 3 a.m. It was a cold day. And the monastery assistant would put up, set a fire, big fire. So they would sit around the fire. So that was an open air fireplace. So that everyone started smiling and getting carried away by chit-chat. Chit-chat also recommended in Dhamma. That is called not the chit-chat that insults someone, not the vulgar one, not the meaningless one. Chit-chat means too important. When everyone got carried away by a decent chit-chat, and he couldn't stand that, then what he did was, he didn't leave the place. He just closed his eyes and shaking his head, and he even he demonstrated. And he maintained a hardly earned mild smile across his face throughout. And then everyone stopped laughing. Everyone was laughing, and they came to when some monks put their, they started patting him. I think you enjoy this company today. And then he was so humble. He was humbled by what he did was, he closed his eyes and think about Hasitupada, Buddha smiling. And then he started perspiring, sweating. So that is called, sometimes, you know, when you get motivated, you may either sweat a lot, or maybe you get goosebumps. So that he said, it was a turning point, he said. What kind of turning point? That smile, by that time he has been there like maybe 18, 19 months already in the forest. See that is why, that's one fine example of middle path. Now you don't, so Buddha simply asked her to avoid this, the extreme of hedonism and extreme of asceticism. But that doesn't mean that you are completely avoid this. You need to eat moderately. Moderate eating, moderate drinking, moderate enjoyment, and all this, you need that. And you maintain everything. You are free to have a hedonist lifestyle. Of course, people need that. However, never go to extremes. Especially when it comes to spiritual practice, don't complain that others are not doing their practice properly. That's why some people get, and that's the bottom line. I noticed that. If you break up with people who are fun and who are still doing spiritual practices, but they don't meet your own standard. There's nothing called standards. Some people really get angry. Mostly, it is not the hedonist people who get angry. It's mostly ascetic people. Thank you for today. See you next Thursday.